Just to introduce myself, I'm Nick Pallavita. I am a tax attorney. I've been practicing law for 34 years now. Licensed to practice before the Florida Bar, the United States Tax Court, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, and the wonderful Supreme Court of the United States. Thank you very much. And I've taken cases to every jurisdiction that I just described. After practicing for 34 years, for the last 7 years, I have been the lead faculty member for the graduate tax program at Northeastern University in Boston. I also am a professor at Campbell University School of Law in Raleigh, and also work in the area of qualified plans, which is what we're going to look at today. Specifically, we're looking at fully insured defined benefit pension plans. Okay, so what is basically a fully insured defined benefit plan? Why do we have to know about this? Here's the main reason people purchase fully insured defined benefit plans or pension plans in general. Most people do it for maximizing the tax benefits. The number one driver that people have for setting up a qualified plan is the tax deduction. And there's very few places you can go in the Internal Revenue Code today to get these tax deductions. We had a client in Hawaii, I forgot what his, some of the incomes are extremely high, and they're looking for places to get tax deductions. Well, we know in the qualified plan space that we work in, you can deduct $300,000 approximately in the defined benefit plan. You can do about $54,000 in a profit-sharing plan. But the real question is, where else do you go besides pensions and profit-sharing plans to get these tax deductions? And frankly, it's a really hard space. You can look at captive insurance companies. And captive insurance companies have certain limitations to them, especially they have been deemed a listed transaction under the 2016 Rep Proc 77, so you have to be very careful with them. You can do double Dutch Irish sandwiches, which is a sophisticated tax shelter used by Apple Computer. They used by Microsoft and, of course, Google. And for those who aren't familiar with the double Dutch, you should be, because it's known as the Irish tax shelter that all the major corporations use. Microsoft has over 400 corporate attorneys doing 482 intercompany price transactions. But they don't fit everybody's scenario because that deals with being able to take technology, sell it offshore, and rent it back, basically, and make sure you go through the 482 regs carefully. Now we look at the qualified plans, defined benefit pensions plans specifically. This is an area of the tax code that is just not well known and understood. And there's two reasons why that I came with after being lead professor at Northeastern University for 7 years. Reason number one, okay. People don't want to know about qualified plans. It's complicated, built to stay that way, and I just don't want to know about it. Reason number two, the information isn't given out there freely to know about. In other words, it's hard to find this information. So it's hard to learn and hard to find what to learn. So in the space I work with in the qualified plan area, there's no competition. It's kind of a weird thing. High demand, no competition. In typical insurance sales, you actually have competition. You show an illustration, Joe shows an illustration. In pension sales, you show an illustration, that's it. That's the only illustration the client will see. They won't pull another one. As a matter of fact, the competition is really how well and how are you going to deal with the employee issues as the business owner wants to put away about $200,000. To give you the numbers, and I've been doing this for 17 years, we've administered over 400 qualified plans. Here are the numbers that you need to know about, which most people don't know unless you run a TPA. The average life insurance premium is $70,000. $70,000, that's your average life premium. Now, I don't know what the other markets are. Matter of fact, Dave Gresham was speaking earlier when he flew in from Indianapolis. I flew in from Raleigh. I said, what do you guys sell? I mean, I have no clue. I know what I do, and I know what the average premium in our industry is at $70,000, but what does the average agent do? I have no clue. In our industry, the average life premium is $70,000. The average annuity premium is $130,000. The average contribution is $200,000. That's been consistent for 17 years. Our lowest case I think we ever did was $66,000 total contribution. I think the life premium is something like in the 20s or 30s. The highest case we did with your company, $2,134,000 per year the clients were putting in the plan. Now, in my area I work in as a tax attorney, we're considered the micro market, the small pension market, less than 1 million annual contributions. Contributions between, I would say we go from 50,000 on the low to about 500,000 on the high. with an average around 200. Now, in life insurance, is $70,000 considered a large or a small premium? I don't know. What do you think, Chris? I would say it would consider a large premium. You know, but it doesn't mean you're going to do a lot of these. In other words, it's not a volume thing. It is a little bit of a niche thing because the average person we work with is a medical professional who's 55 years old, who's making about $400,000 a year and looking to put away more than 100 for his or her retirement. The one we just finished up in Roseburg, I think they're doing about, their budget was around 200, 250. We just did one in Hawaii around 250 was their budget. And it seems to be we get a lot of $250,000 into these qualified plans. Now, reason number two, people don't know much about these plans. How many of you took retirement plans when you were in high school? Please raise your hand. Qualified plans, anybody? See, I do this all the time. No one took it. Okay, when you're in college, did you take retirement plans and qualified plans, anybody, as a class? You took retirement? No. How about MBA school? No. Well, you might have, Brad. You said no. Okay. Well, I've been teaching at Northeastern University as lead faculty member for 7 years, and I get paid a lot of money to teach, but it's a private school and it's very expensive to go to. It's like, I would say 10 times more expensive than BYU. And so part of what I do is I do some research on it, and I found out that in retirement plans in the United States, Stanford, Harvard, Yale, University of Chicago, all major universities, including this one, does not offer a retirement plan class. In other words, you can go through their curriculum. It's all online. You say, where's your retirement plan class? There isn't any. So what we have is a huge group of people that have no knowledge of it. Now, is it by design? In other words, we don't want you to know, because if you did know, you maybe do something different. Or is it because of accident? We don't want to know. Because it's complicated. I mean, that'll be up to the, you know, people can argue those positions either way. But there are some basics that you do need to know, and of course you've been through the class before, you'll know this, and the ones who haven't won't. Let's imagine you have a client who comes to you and they say, I'd like to set up a retirement plan. I'd love to have a 401k. Anyone here for 401k? 401k? Please say you did. Thank you. Okay. Now, you're in the insurance business. I'm assuming any of you here have a 412e3. 412e3? Yes, sir. Okay. Now you have two choices, 412e3 or 401k. And my question to you, and you cannot answer that question because you know the answer, but they may or may not. What is a more tax-efficient vehicle to set up for retirement, a 401k plan or a 412e3 plan? What's more tax-efficient? The 412e3. Now the question, next question is, why is a 412e3 more tax-efficient than a 401k? Why? Okay, besides putting more money in, I'm saying it's purely tax more efficient. Why would you tell a client, oh, you want to do a 401k, you want to put in $24,000, $18,000 plus $6,000, top up $24,000. I'm going to show you a fully insured defined benefit plan. You're going to put in the same $24,000. It's more tax efficient. The reason why is? It has nothing to do with insurance products. Sir, at the back, yes? Guess? No? Okay. By the way, here's something interesting about ERISA. Once you know this, you can't take the knowledge back. You know it forever. It's just a weird little thing. You know, and a lot of people in my industry, they don't want to give the knowledge away. At $350 an hour, I'll tell you. But since you're at this class, I'll tell you for free. Here's the reason why. If you set up a 401k plan, they're called salary deferral plans. And as one federal judge told me, follow the money. The money goes from your corporation to yourself as salary. When it goes to you as salary, do you pay Social Security and Medicare taxes? Yes. Social Security tax is 6.2%, plus you own your own business, so you have to match it. It's another 6.2, it's 12.4. You also owe Medicare taxes, 1.45. And since you own your own business, you have to match it, 1.45, 2.9. You add both these taxes together, it's 15.3. So the $28,000 that you had planned to save for your $24,000 you planned to save retirement, you took out 15.3% in Social Security and Medicare taxes. Then you put them into the plan. A 15.3% upfront load. Now let's go to the fully insured plan. Yes, you're going to see the advantage, which our industry does a horrible, with a capital H, job of marketing and understanding this. We're going to show you a fully insured defined benefit plan, sir, and here's what's going to happen. The money will go from your small corporation, or S-Corp, directly to the plan. When it goes from your S-Corp directly to the plan, under line 17, Or line 23, if it's a C corp, are any Social Security and Medicare taxes taken out?
No.
The answer is no. Yes, sir, you are correct. You save 15.3% every year. So I learned this, and I'd been practicing tax law from 1984 to 2001. And I started an administration company and hired two really brilliant enrolled actuaries. One was the PricewaterhouseCoopers for 26 years, and they said, you don't want a 401k. I said, what are you talking about? Everybody has it. I said, no, you don't understand. That's because it's marketed better. I said, you want either a profit sharing or you want a pension plan. And the reason why, you don't have to pay the Social Security and Medicare taxes. I said, are you kidding me? I said, no, you save 15.3% every year. So I had to do my own analysis because I was shocked. You know, I'd been practicing law. No one ever told me that. I have a master's in tax law. I have a master's in business administration. I have a law degree, practiced before the tax. They never told me that. So I did my research, and you know what? They're right. They're absolutely bloody right. It's more tax efficient to have a fully insured defined benefit plan than it is a 401k. What we've experienced the last several decades is the mutual fund industry is much smarter and bigger in marketing than the insurance industry. Because I'm going to go to the next step. So now we set up our fully insured defined benefit plan. Now I'm doing a small one. I can tell you, we never did one. They only had 24,000 in it. I said the smallest is like 60. But all you do is ratchet the numbers up, and it's the same concept. Okay, so you put the money in the plan, but if you look at the rules under fully insured defined benefit plans, otherwise known as 412(e)(3), there's only two types of investments. This is one reason everybody in this conference should know about it. Notice not everybody's attending, so they won't. That's okay. That's their loss, not mine. I don't care. I have a lot of work to do back at the office. Okay, so let's look at the only two types of investments allowed. One is a whole life insurance contract. How many people have ever sold whole life? Please raise your hand. Okay, that's investment number one. You just found it. The other investment that's allowed is a fixed annuity. Anybody sell fixed annuities? Yep, that's the other investment. End of investment world. Your investment knowledge doesn't have to be huge because those are the only two that are allowed, a whole life and a fixed annuity contract. How much goes in the whole life? How much goes in the annuity? The maximum in the whole life is 50%. And the balance goes in the annuity, 50%. You can do less in the whole life. Notice when I said our average contribution is 70,000 life, 130 in annuity, we usually balance more to the annuity for this reason. Because I remember I've administered a lot of these plans over years. Year two, client calls, ring, I can't put the 200,000, I'm having a bad year, I can only put 170. So we got to reduce the contribution of 30. Do we reduce it from the annuity or the life contract? The annuity, because can you reduce the life contract? And the answer is no. And now that's the reason we don't run what I call 50-50 plans. Could we have done 100 life, 100 annuity? Yes, legally we could. But by year two, our office has done a lot of it. We know that we're out of compliance because not because of us. It's because the client can't fund the entire amount that they had scheduled to fund for cash flow purposes. There's only two conversations. All the insurance annuity is gone. You use whatever. I mean, there's no competition. The conversation you have with your client is cash flow. Can they afford to put in that amount? You know, a lot of them say, oh, yeah, I can put in 250. But really? Can you do it every year? Well, I'm not sure. Okay, let's do a budget so that we make sure we know what your retirement contributions are going to be. The other conversation you have with your client is, who's going to be in the plan? I've got 10 employees. Do I have to bring them all in? No, you don't. You could have 10 employees. You don't have to bring in any of them. You could be the only one in the plan. How? It's not being an employee, it's being an eligible employee. There's a difference. Now, John and Charles, who Brad knows, are two EAs who have since retired from our company, said we should spend 2 weeks on eligibility investing. I said, look, the producers don't have 2 weeks to spend on eligible investing. Could you? Yes. But we're going to spend a couple minutes before I go to my program on eligibility investing. Not everybody's eligible. To be eligible to participate in the plan, you must have worked there for at least a year. So if you have people that haven't been there a year, they're not eligible. The business owner's always been there a year. But you may have employees, we just hired a couple in our, they're not eligible. As a matter of fact, they may not be eligible for a year and a half because you put dual entry dates in. Matter of fact, we had one of our, what did we do? Maybe it was some of our students do an exercise. We'll do one right now. You hire somebody today. You hired two employees today. Are they eligible? No. You are, because you're the business owner. You've been there for a year. hired two employees today. Next year, they're eligible. So it's 2017. Let's go to 2018. What would be September 10th? Is it, where are we at? September 13th? Whatever. 14th. I don't even know what date it is. September, I've been on the road. I've been to Hawaii, Florida, and I'm here. September 14th, they're now eligible. Do we need to bring them in the plan on September 14th if you have a dual entry date? The answer is no. The dual entry dates mean the entry dates are January 1st and July 1st. So let's roll it through. I hired somebody today. Next year, they're eligible for the 1 year, but the entry date isn't until to January 1st. So they're actually eligible January 1st of 2018. Now I have to make a plan contribution for them for 2018. When is that plan contribution due? It's due on September 15th of 2019. So hiring a person today doesn't necessarily mean you even make a plan contribution, even though they're eligible, because it takes so long to become eligible and then it takes so long. So now you make a plan contribution, is it vested? No, they have to be there for at least 6 years, or if you use a 3 year cliff, 6 years before they're fully vested in it, which means if they quit or you fire them, you get the money back that you just put in for the plan for them. Next question, you have 10 employees, you find they're all eligible. Do you need to bring all 10 of them in the pension plan with you? No. By rule, and this is called 401A26 for the code freaks that never seem to show up, you can exclude up to 60% of the eligible employees. You only need to bring in 40. So here's a typical plan. The two doctors and their two spouses who work in their medical practice are in the plan. The other six are in a 401K profit sharing plan. They're not even the defined benefit plan. So a defined benefit plan has a lot more contributions and benefits. In other words, $200,000 per each doctor, there's $400,000, plus the spouses who may have smaller salaries and they get $40,000 or $50,000 each. You know. And then the balance are in a 401k profit sharing plan. So you don't even have to include them. And that's just by rule. Now what I'm describing, by the way, is what I call retirement plan 101. Everybody who graduated from high school should know about. But don't, because our financial education is really, really horrible in the United States, which we just talked to PBS today, and they're not interested in they're not interested in giving aid by financial education, just to let you know. So I thought it was pretty cute. I said, well, let everybody know, PBS has no interest in letting you guys know how this stuff works. Fine, okay? I do, it's kind of been my mission, because when they come to the graduate tax program, I find these really bright students and they've never taken retirement planning class. And some of it's basic stuff that you need to know. Now, if you're in the insurance industry, we do know this. We only have two products. But some people want to go, wait, I want to have something in the stock market. Fine. Can you set up a 401k plan and deduct that, have them put $24,000 because they're over age 50, plus do the defined benefit plan? And the answer is yes. So we put their fun money in the 401k. I call it the fun gambling money, the Fitbit stock, the Rite Aid stock. All I'm talking about all my dogs this year. Last year I was talking about BlackBerry because it was a dog. I buy these dog stocks. I mean, yeah, I buy them on the 52-week high low and they go lower. And I'm going like, are you kidding me? You know, and everybody says the market goes up. Let me tell you, it doesn't. If you're an investor, you know better than that. And your clients know better than that. It's a dog place to play. And that's where you put your fun money. The serious money is in your pension plan. And it goes only one direction, which is what? Up in value. Every year, boom, up, 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 doesn't go down in value. So it becomes a great place to park your serious money. The insurance products are like 10 times better than when I first started. Most of the products that we work with today, if you put in $70,000 a year for 10 years, you put in $700,000. You surrender it, you get $770,000 back, which is not bad. It passes all through all the CPAs. Every plan I work with, we're going to work with a CPA. They go, well, let me see the insurance product. And they look at that and go, I've never seen one like that. It's because you're a CPA. You're not in the industry. You don't know these things out there. Yes, sir?
So does an index annuity work?
Yes, it does, but it's under the BICE rules coming forward, the best interest contract. So we tend to do fixed annuities. But you can use equity index annuities. And actually, we had them in our plan. You know, other than the BICE rules, they work because they have a floor guarantee plus a crediting rate, whichever is greater. So they're fine, and they will qualify under Section 412(e)(3). So you could use index annuities, you can use fixed annuities, and that'll represent at least half the contribution. The other half will be in the whole life contract. Another thing about the whole life contract, which is very interesting, is why do people buy whole life contracts? why does my doctor, who's making $500,000 a year, purchase a whole life contract for $3 million, $3.5 million? Why does he do it? Well, yeah, but what about this death benefit? Does he need it? No, he's dead. Anybody who buys an insurance contract doesn't need it. They're dead. But what about his wife who spends $20,000 per month on living expenses? Remember, kids in private education, mortgages, cars. If you start adding up lifestyle, it's what I call the basic $20,000 a month lifestyle. Doctor's making $500,000 a year, he drops dead. Who comes in and pays the $20,000 per month to keep them in their home? Doctor died. He's making $500,000 a year. Where does his earnings stream go? Oh, yeah, Lafayette Life. You get the Lafayette insurance policy, you're correct. That's where the death benefit comes into play. And this is traditional. It goes back to 1974 and beyond. Actually, it goes back to, let's say, MetLife in 1921, which created the first basically fully insured defined benefit plan. The whole theory was the death benefit is to replace the earnings capacity of the breadwinner until you reach enough money in the plan to support that, which is about $3.5 million. So a lot of life death benefits are about $3.5 million. Some are $1,750,000 because we use the 100 times monthly earnings rule. But we always have death benefits in the plan, almost always, unless they fail the physical. Most of them pass the physical because the average age is 45 to 65 in this particular market, so they'll pass the physical. And they get the death benefit because the death benefit today provides living benefits, long-term care, chronic illness, terminal illness, which at no additional cost they do now today. So I would say that we're looking at probably 80, 90% of our plans are not our what they call split-funded life and annuity. And then some of them, they'll fail the physical. Can't do anything about it. Does that mean you don't have a case? Nope, becomes annuity only. Except that we can't fund the death benefit because we can't pass physical. Yes, sir, in the back.
Would you say probably the ideal age, you know, maximum age, like 55 or so?
Oh, definitely it's 55. And I'll tell you why. Why isn't 55 the ideal age? Because the way the code is structured, normal retirement age is 62, 65, or 5 years participation, which means you can do a 70-year-old fund for 5 years and they retire. The oldest we did was a 75 retirement age, 80, an attorney in Seattle. Why is 55 the optimal age? It's because of the amount of contribution from 55 to 65, which is a 10-year spread, you can put the maximum amount in if he's 55. If he's 56, we can't. You lose your benefit. You lose 10% of your benefits each year you cannot fund for 10 years. And a lot of people don't understand. What I call a back-off. So if you have somebody who's age 60, they can only fund for 5 years because normal retirement age 65. Hence, your benefit formula cannot be $215,000. It can only be
$107,500.
The rule is age 62, 65, or 5 years participation. In other words, if you have let's say you meet a 68-year-old, could he set up a plan? Yes, you can fund it for 5 years. But can he fund the maximum benefit, which under the code is $215,000 a year for the rest of his life? The answer is no, because according to the regs, you have to reduce the benefit formula 10% each year. You don't fund for 10 years. It's impossible to fund 10 years a 68-year-old.
So if it's, say, 55 years old, I can do it for 10 years, how much money can they put into it?
About $350,000, maybe $400,000, depending on which products you purchase and how you structure them in the plan. They get about $400,000 deduction. Yeah, doctors, dentists, architects, lawyers, engineers, and people are in niche business with high income. One we just finished up was in Hawaii. They actually they install flooring for Home Depot. I didn't know they could, and their budget is $250,000 a year to put in the plan. So we structured the plan to give them $250,000. You know, this is a whole different world than most people have ever experienced, because in the D.C. world, the maximum is 25% of comp to maximum of $54,000. Nor do you cap at 54. That's DC, 401k, that world. That's the unsophisticated world of the people that don't know what's going on. The DB world has a different, what they call 415 limit. It's the maximum amount to fund a guaranteed lifetime income. $215,000 a year, reduced 10%. Each year you don't fund for 10 years to the maximum of your compensation, whichever is lower. So if your compensation is only $100,000, I can't fund for a $215,000 benefit. Oh, 350? Actuarially, let's imagine, and I'm just going to give you a hypothetical with a low interest rate, zero interest rate environment. $350,000 over 10 years with no interest rate will be about $3.5 million. $3.5 million, depending on what annuity conversion rate you use, will translate to a $215,000 income.
So that's a low interest rate environment.
It's a low interest rate environment. That's the reason why we have such large contributions.
So 3 to 4%, you know, you're looking at
it might go down a bit if you use a higher interest rate annuity. See, it depends what annuity you pull off the shelf. If I go in the shelf and I go, the guy wants the highest deduction, let's pull a 1% guarantee annuity, or some of them guaranteed no, like the index, but we don't think we can use no, so we try to use like 0.5%, then your funding levels go up because you have a lower guarantee. If you go to your annuity desk and you're pulling a higher guarantee, like your wonderful company, then our contributions actually go down. It works counterintuitive. It's got a great company. It's not a good company. If you happen to stop by Lafayette, great company. And I shouldn't be biased toward companies, but I am. In the retirement market, and I don't care what company you work with, you definitely want to do Lafayette. Pardon? What? Well, the thing is, the carrier market has changed. I mean, in 17 years, when we first started, the carrier market and products have changed. A lot of the carriers have pulled out of the market. We were the exclusive TPA for a company called Principal Financial. You may have never heard of them. But anyway, Principal is a pretty big company. They have no fully insured defined benefit market products, zero. New York Life pulled out. You may have heard of them. They're a company that you may or not want to keep. If you're with New York Life, forget it. They're gone. MetLife, forget it. Gone. Hartford, gone. Who pulled out? Ohio National, gone. So we survived that because we just go to different companies. You know, we look, matter of fact, Brad over there is a product maven. He looks at all his companies and he says, well, you want to go to this one? Look at that one. But we have to also make sure they qualify, because sometimes you look at an annuity and you say, oh, this annuity is the one I want to use. We do our research on it because we are ERISA fiduciaries, just like you are today, whether you like it or not. And we have to look at it to see whether it's compliant, but we have done this for years, so we look at it anyway. And we say, oh, you have a non-unisex annuity. Well, that violates the U.S. Supreme Court case back in 1982, for those who read it, Arizona versus Norris, which means you can't use that annuity. Because remember, we are not in the insurance industry. We are in the pension industry. Anybody who comes and works with our company and thinks they're an insurance agent, forget it. You know, we'll bounce you out so fast, make your head spin. We are in the pension industry. You are a plan fiduciary and you act that way. And that's the way we act and that's the way we work with our clients. So we make sure we have the best possible products that we can find for them, support for what we do, and make sure the plans are in compliance with the Department of Labor, the IRS, and the PBGC. That's what we do, NPP. Yeah, bless me, I could lose my law license. I have a law license independent of NPP. Yeah, absolutely. In other words, our product guru over there will say, hey, let's look at this product and that product for it. So absolutely we'll do that, you know. And we'll give you the reasons why. And also, I'll do this, find a better product. And you can't, you know. In other words, after 34 years in this industry, I think we know a little bit about how to do it. And going through more than a dozen audits with our friends at the IRS. Oh, I live in Raleigh, Durham. Our headquarters are actually in Utah. We work all over the country. We have about 60 affiliates offices around the United States, but our headquarters are in Utah.
Do they go to you
No, they would actually go to our everything goes through our headquarters here in Salt Lake. Everything's reviewed through our enrolled actuaries, our CPAs, our attorneys, before it goes out to the client. And it's all done on the internet. So you can live anywhere. It doesn't really matter. I live in Raleigh, Durham. I'm do everything on the internet. Yeah. Everything's through GoToMeeting, emails, et cetera, and it all works. You know. So that's kind of like the basics of what we do in the qualified plan space. And the main reason they do it, tax deductions. Now later on, they'll actually clients will look at it and say, wow, I have an account, when can I retire? And we run our calculations. Here's your lifetime income, here's your lump sum amount. Because a lot of cases, they'll choose the lump sum when they go to retire. It also shelters assets from legal liability and creditors. But fact is, I only had one client. It was from Helena, Montana, a doctor, who called me up. We had about $1.5 million in his plan. He goes, I want to terminate the plan. I said, fine, you can terminate the plan, but what are you going to just remember? The minute you leave the plan, your assets are no longer protected from creditors. Calls me the next day, I don't want to terminate the plan. I go, why? You're a doctor. He goes, you understand, the doctor thing's not a problem. It's the $5 million note I sign on a real estate deal in Hawaii that's about to go under. And if I transfer these assets, I lose $1.5 million to the creditor. Why they sit in the qualified plan, they're exempt from lawsuits and creditor claims. I will tell you, in practice, over 400 plans, we designed over 1,000 of them. administered over 400, maybe 500. No one does it because of asset protection. You know, we only talk about it as an afterthought for sheltering assets from legal liability and creditors. It's a great asset protection tool, but they don't do it. They do it for number one reason, tax benefits. If you're a high income taxpayer, and I'm sure they've gone over this in conference, you lose PEP, you lose P's, you have here in Utah, you have a state income tax, federal income tax, you have Obamacare taxes, and they frankly just get tired of paying taxes. Wouldn't they rather, and I'm talking about a high income taxpayer, take the $100,000 and rather than take it to income, push it into a qualified plan, say $50,000. Now they're using half of it for their pensions. But the CPA will never discuss the pension with them. Why won't the CPA discuss a pension with them? Complex is reason number one, but I'll go to reason number two. Can a CPA do a pension plan for a client? The answer is no. Part of the reason they can't do it is legally they can't sign the Schedule SB on the Form 5500. And 5500 is a very interesting form. You have to buy the software, as we know, from the IRS-approved vendors to even run a 5500 SF. But a Schedule SB can't be signed by a CPA. So since they can't do it and they can't make one dime doing it, what do they tell the client? Don't do it. Right. That's where we come in.
CPA recommends
usually a 401k profit sharing plan. Or a SEP. SEP doesn't cost anything. They fill out a 5305. They do a SEP 25% of pay to a maximum of $54,000. That is it. And they keep their clients in the bloody dark about this area. Two reasons. A, they don't know. B, they can't execute it if they did know. And I lecture to CPAs across the country. I have a room of 300 at the University of Denver, which I've done for the last 3 years, and I go through the same questions, you know, about this stuff. They don't even know the basics of it. And I said, well, why don't you CPAs know? Do CPAs ever take a qualified plan class? No, the reason why it's not offered, unless you go to a master's in tax. So the reason they don't do it, they don't know and they can't execute. But we do have to run interference all the time with CPA firms. I have no problem as a tax attorney running interference, running roughshod basically over any CPA in the country regarding this. Because I know what they know and I know what they don't know. And what they don't know, unfortunately, is a lot when it comes to this area. Now, would I say 1040s or 1065s? No, I know nothing about that. That's the world of the CPA. I don't do that. But in this area, that's a different story. The form that you fill out at the end of the year is the 5500. Okay, that is your pension return. And there's a schedule in the 5500. It's called Schedule SB. It can only be signed by an enrolled actuary, and CPAs are not enrolled actuaries. So what they do is they don't do these at all. You need to reduce your taxable income significantly. Substantial survivor benefits, and of course you have the retirement. It provides retirement benefits, disability or death benefits. Now this is very interesting. In a pension plan, it actually does provide disability, but it's not funded. It's the value of the life insurance annuity converted to lifetime income in the event somebody hits a disability, but it's unfunded, so I never tell them to drop their disability policy because it's small early on. It's only the cash value being returned, and that's it. Must meet specific IRC requirements, qualifies for tax favored treatment, but cannot discriminate. But that may, yes, sir, question, hit it. Like, beautiful question. Do you want to know the IRS position or our position? Okay, I'll give you the IRS position. You can't put waiver premium on it. Cannot put waiver premium on it. That's the IRS's position. There's no legal substantiation of their position whatsoever, except their interpretation of the Internal Revenue Code. The code says you must guarantee the benefits to normal retirement age, and their opinion of the service is that that's an extra expense that doesn't fit the code section. The legal aspects of it is it's never been challenged in court, nor there's a court case or a statute or a ruling that supports their position. So from a litigation standpoint, the question is, does your client want to litigate that? I'd be willing to litigate it, but I could not guarantee they'd win it or lose it. So we don't do it. Pardon? No, we don't. In other words, we don't because of what I just said, like you said, don't. But I have researched that issue infinitum to see, because we have basically what they call it, documented potential litigation positions. Unfortunately, right now, my litigation department is zero. We have no challenges by the service. We just finished one of the audits a couple months ago, and so life is boring right now, so I just speak on it. Without a good audit and a good fight, there's nothing to do. Sorry, guy. This can be a real boring place to work. All right, taxable income is reduced by the amount contributed, retirement savings, and the account goes tax-free. We all know that. Two types of plans, DC, DB. DB, now this is for the producers who worked in the 1970s, the 1960s. This was the purview of the life insurance industry. Everybody in the life insurance industry, if you want to be trained on a defined benefit plan, you went to work for a major insurance company. And their whole mantra was DBs because they realized their sustainable competitive advantage. Then came the changes in TRA 86 and Oberon 89, diminishing the defined benefit plans, the small plan market, from about 150,000 to 50,000 plans that exist today, because what they did is, remember that benefit form I said 215,000 was reduced down to 90 overnight. And people terminated the small DB plans. The numbers weren't looking good. Now they brought it all back in 2001 with EGTRA. But by that time, all the people who had knowledge of this had retired or died. So even though it was brought back, the insurance industry did nothing. In the meantime, the mutual fund industry understood the asset under management charges they could get on 401k. They pushed their industry through, and the big mantra is DC. The other reason is this. If you're in a large company, do you want a DB plan or a DC plan? You work for IBM. Do you want a DB or a DC? You want the DC, because who pays for the DC retirement contributions, the company or the employees? The employees, correct. And I'm a manager at IBM. My compensation is stock options to drive the stock up. Do I want to contribute $1 billion to my pension plan for the benefit of the employees or distribute $1 billion to my shareholders? Which do I want to do and bring up the value of the stock? The shareholders, of course. So what happens is pensions are terminated and have been that way for large companies because the compensation mainly for executives is stock options. It's not pensions. So today, large pensions have gone down because there's no value in it and drives the stock down. Now I'm a doctor, I own my company. And what happens is I contribute the pension. Remember, what happens, profits go down, taxes go down, profits go down, and my stock goes down. Does the doctor care about the stock in his professional practice? No. So what market moves up in the pension market? It's the small pension market. Because the only disadvantage is it drives down the value of your stock, but who cares if it's a closely held business owner, CHOB. So the DB plan movement upwards has been in the small market. The large market has terminated it. DC has moved up in the large market because they're pushing it to the employees to pay for their benefits, not the company. Because remember, a DB plan has one big disadvantage. It's all company contributions. All comes from the company, nothing from the employee. And this will be a disadvantage if you go see a prospect, oh, I make $1 million a year, I own an automobile dealership, how many employees do you have? 100. You're not a good prospect. You can make $1 million, but not, because your employee costs will eat up all the potential benefits of your tax deductions. So it's the small business plans that have been moved rapidly. Yeah, how many employees you have relative to the business owner? Usually less than 50. You know, if you have more than 50, it's usually the numbers won't work. But if 50 or less, numbers are good. 10 or less, better. Single is even the best, the single employer DB. In other words, you only have one business owner who doesn't have any employees. I mean, that's the dream case that walks in the door. So, you know, somebody goes, well, you know, I'm a doctor, I have my own practice, I really have a part-time employee, and I do all the work and I make $300,000 a year. Perfect. When does that perfect client walk in the door? You know, because then there's no employee issues. Remember, there's only two issues you're going to deal with. Employee issues, right? And their budget. Forget all the insurance issues. They sign all that and they fund it. That's not a big deal. You know, it'll be those two issues. That's it. Smaller the demographic group, the better. Okay, those are the benefits, retirement benefits. I'm going to skip through this stuff because it's bloody boring. Yes?
The employee, yeah. Full-time employee.
Yes, correct. Full-time. Oh, you can have 100 part-timers and no problem. In other words, if they're working less than 1,000 hours, you don't even include them. They're not even eligible. They're as if they don't exist. And we have that. Sometimes we'll get data and we'll see, they'll have like 50 or 60 employees that they thought, and none of them are eligible because none of them work 1,000 hours. They haven't been there for a year. In a restaurant industry, I say just put a two-year eligibility. Two-year eligibility, and they're never in.
Never.
Yeah, you never put anybody in.
And what's the
Yeah, you just put it to your eligibility. So there's a lot you can do. You just have to know about what to do. There's within reason. Here's the reason. There aren't too much. 1 year or 2 years, that's it. So I can get up to 2 years. If you said 3 year eligibility, I can't do 3 years. I could do 1 year or 2 year eligibility. But I could do a 2 year with a dual entry date. So it could literally be 2.5 years before they go in.
And you can change the vesting.
And you can change the vesting, right. Yes. When you, yeah, see, you, our general plan, we do a 1 year eligibility and a 6 year vesting. So contributions go out. Go into the plan, and the employee goes, oh, I think I'm going to get it. And then they quit, and they all come back to us. Well, they come back to the plan, back to the plan sponsor. So you can make sure it vests over a period of 6 years. Sometimes the six-year vesting is good if you have a group of engineers, and they're worried about engineers leaving. I said, well, we'll drop a six-year vesting, and they ain't leaving. You know, if somebody puts a plan together, and they go, I want to keep that employee, I'll just do a one-year eligibility, six-year vesting, which means for the next 6 years, you leave, you can give me money on the way out the door. A lot of people don't like to do that. So they're going to stick for 6 years, especially the engineering firm. So we have a lot of small engineering firms like that. Yes, sir, in the back.
So
what
if you have a client who has a 401k for a number of years?
Mm-hmm. Maybe they got
paid
business
employees.
Right.
They want to convert
to
this.
Yeah.
Can they roll everything in their 401k?
Yeah.
Right. Can they roll this stuff into the DB plan?
Okay, on the 401k, because it's 401k money, it'd have to go to a suspense account, otherwise known as a 414k account. So we could not put that, nor would it count as a defined benefit or 412e3 contribution, but there is a special account for, just so that you don't have to pay the extra administration to administer a 401k, is a 414k. Best thing to do with a demographic like that, if you had, how many people do you have in the plan, in the 401k? Give me a number. 50. 40% of the eligible employees can go to the DB plan. The rest can stay in the 401k plans. 40% means that you have 20 in the DB. Select the best 20, put them in the DB, give them huge contributions to keep everybody else in the 401k. And then you have to give them what they call the gateway contribution, or 1.4184-8, otherwise known as 7.5% of pay. And you'll pass 4184, 410B, 4184-8, and hopefully 4184 independently. So can that be done? Yes. Can it work for the client? Yes, because most of them don't say, hey, we want to benefit all 50. And I have to bring in 40%, at least 20. Could I do 25? Yeah, I can always do more, but 20. And so they said, would you like to benefit the best 20? Yeah, tell me the best 20, and we'll set up the formulas and benefits for them. Now the question is non-discrimination. Again, I haven't seen the demographics. If they're making more than 120,000, they're considered highly compensated employees under ERISA. If they're a 5% shareholder, which means there's no non-discrimination testing, which means we can do what they call tiered benefit format, which means I can give different contributions to each individual, which we did with a urology group in Omaha, Nebraska. So one doctor wants to put away 100,000, we give them that, another one wants to put away 20, we give them that, one wants to put 80, one wants to put away 200. How can you do all that? Read the regs. No non-discrimination testing if you have only a group of HCEs within the plan. Or you test within the HCE group. And highly compensated employees, by definition, make more than 120,000, which doctors are, or a 5% shareholder, which means you can make 40 and be a highly compensated employee. So there are things you can do with the demographic. Our goal is to find out, once you open up the space to the client, show them what they could do, then we ask, what do you guys want to do? And we'll design the plan that makes sense for them. You know. Yeah, you could work with that. Or if you want to be boring, you can drop it all in a suspense account and start a DB plan form. You know, we do this again. We try to match what they're trying to accomplish once we open their eyes to that. And one thing, they probably never took a retirement planning class, so this is all news to them. All the Aspen NIPA people and the people who work in this area, I hate to say what I'm telling you all day, it's all old news. There's nothing here that is interesting or exciting. It's same thing over and over again, just a different day. Guaranteed retirement benefits, okay, we don't want to go through that. First year contributions, you can do a lot larger. This is wonderful. Who cares? Let's go to the tax planning. Okay, now what's going on here? Well, making more than $450,000, we have the third 9.6% bracket. That doesn't make these people too happy. Plus, the Obamacare surcharge, 3.8, plus capital gains tax going up, plus payroll taxes, plus PEP and Ps, and then this wonderful chart, state income taxes. Since we work all over the country, We have clients that come everywhere. We have clients from Florida to Virginia to Alaska to Hawaii, and look at some of these taxes. Most of our cases come from the great state of California with a 13.3%. You know why. Pretty heavy, baby. And then they end up retiring in Nevada. Well, you know why. We can give you this if you want. It's also on the Internet Tax Foundation. It's not a big deal. But here's the reason why. Remember, it's deductible from federal, state taxes, income, state income taxes, Social Security and Medicare taxes. So eliminate 15.3 plus 13.3. Then when we retire and move to Nevada, we start taking distributions out, RMD. But we can kiss the state of California goodbye as we pay nothing. So you've permanently eliminated the state income tax and the Social Security and Medicare taxes. Seriously. Yeah, if you know, it's pretty heavy on the high end. I mean, you know, a lot of our clients in the high end, they look at this stuff. Look at Hawaii, 11%. Oregon, 9%. A lot of people cross the board and they retire in Washington, which has no state income tax. Our state taxes differ very wide. Where I live, they're showing North Carolina at 7.75. We just reduced to 5.75, so this map is old. The beauty of working in this area, there will be changes, so not everything is completely fixed, so it's in within a range. But something you do need to know about, we recently, one of our clients, Hawaii, we found out he's really domiciled in Nevada. I wonder why. You know, good question. Okay, boring. Who cares about insurance cost? Okay, I want to look at, yeah, question, sure. Yeah, you would think they would, but I will refer you to the Forbes article that it's harder for them to do that than they think because they have no jurisdiction over you once you leave their state. Okay, and Forbes had a huge article on it, which I have, about people retiring in states that have no income taxes and they can't get clawbacks. Now, what states are attempting to do, and may happen in the future, is try to do interstate compacts to bring them back. But it's harder to do than you think. So if you pack up your bags, you leave California, move to Nevada, and they say, we want to tax you on the income here. You go, where's your jurisdiction? There isn't any. Jurisdiction is a big problem in the law. I can tell you that. I mean, you look at jurisdictional issues, and they go, they don't have a goodbye. We're out of here. Okay, these are just larger contributions. Let's see this. Professionals. All right. This is 5 ER doctors, 8 emergency room physicians, 48 to 56 with 3 employees. 2 endodontists, age 48, conservative investor, 5 employees, CPA, 4 partners. So there's quite a few people we do in the professional market space. Sometimes, I'm forgetting this particular plan. Dentist, age 55, retires at 60 W income of 398. There are 3 employees, age 28 to 48, 35 to 50. Change the W-2 to 210, form the fully insured plan. Now the owner's contribution, what they receive is $197,000. The employees are $34,000. I can tell you in practice, here's the problem. This is not the problem for them. This is a problem for them. They really don't want to, as they would tell me, give my employees $34,000. So a lot of the work we do is we try to figure out, okay, how can we structure it with the least amount going to the employees? Some is quite simple. You say, have you hired your spouse? No. You can, because eliminated 415E back in 2006, effective 2010, so you bring your spouse in as an employee and kick one of the other ones out, reduces the cost on that side. So some of the what I call pre-pension planning is done by looking at the demographics and figuring out how we can optimize to the business owner and their key employees and minimize the employee cost. But if you look at this from a tax saving per employee cost, they're actually ahead financially to set up a pension plan for them. These are actual cases. This is a doctor who's making $493,000. And they're putting in $55,000, not realizing that they could actually put in $205,000. But once they do that, it changes their tax situation. It drops their taxes. He was paying $193,000. We dropped him to $95,000. Saved him over $100,000 in taxes every year. Did he implement the plan? Yes. Of course. Is he a client? Yes. You can't get rid of these people. Once you work in the pension area, they become your clients, and they'll be your clients for the next 10 years. They will not leave. 55-year-old college professor with consulting income has a salary, but he can put away a lot of his profits as possible because of the consulting income. In other words, if you work for a educational institution and you're an employee, you can't do anything with that income. But if you have a side business, you can. And so a lot of the professors, And I can tell you the professors here at BYU, they don't even know they could do it. You know, because we hire our actuarial students come from BYU, right, Brad? Do they teach pensions and profit sharing plans at BYU? And the answer is?
Zip.
None. So they don't even know they can do this, but they could if they want to, and they would if they knew. BYU professor, all you have to do is this. If you have outside income, you can't do anything with your income from BYU because the employer has to sponsor it. But your outside income could all be sheltered using a qualified plan. They won't know about it because there's no qualified plan courses offered here. Oh, well. Could a fully insured defined benefit plan help Mary? And the answer is yes. These are pension contributions. Again, as you keep running the data over and over again, the plan contribution, this is just showing the difference between the fully insured and a solo 401k plan. These are such small savings. Is it worth doing? I don't know. But we, you know, when you have the actuaries and say, hey, work on this project so we can take a look at it, we run it through our office, we say, this is interesting. To have the difference between a small fully insured defined benefit plan versus a 401k plan, you save $3,500 per year. In other words, you don't want your 401k. Not for investment purposes, but for other purposes. Yes, sir, in the back.
So what does it cost
to set
one up?
Mm-hmm. Yep, good question. The death benefit can be tax-free. If you re-include the PS58 cost, you can get the death benefit out tax-free if you die while you're a participant in the plan. The cost of setting up a pension. Now, there's a difference between a pension plan, which we do, a pension cash balance, and a fully insured. To do a pension plan, it's about $5,000 a year, $5,000 a year to administer, so it's about 10 grand. If you want to do a traditional defined benefit plan, and investments are stocks, bonds, mutual funds. If you don't want to do a fully insured plan, it's $1,500 to set up $1,500 a year. Why is there such a spread downwards between a fully insured and a traditional? Here's the reason why. In a traditional plan, I have to have a Schedule SB signed by an enrolled actuary every year at $300 an hour. In a fully insured, I don't. Why not? Because the schedule that we use is the guaranteed rate of the insurance and annuity contract, and it's not required on the $5,500, so the administration costs are down. Why else? We don't have the PBGC insurance premiums as high. We don't have the compliance as high because everything's on a guaranteed platform. So the costs are less, $1,500. If they have never set up a plan before, a qualified plan, they've only had SEPs and simples, they also get a tax credit of $500 every year for 3 years as long as they fill out Form 8881 from the Internal Revenue Service, bringing their net cost to $1,000 a year for 3 years. And so the full insured, frankly, is easier to administer because every year we can go check the data, we know what's in the plan. DB plans are not. You know, when we had a DB plan that lost, we had one in California, they lost $37,000 one year, and the penalty was $37,000 because of their losses. Much harder to administer. One neurosurgeon in Bellingham, Washington, lost $250,000, and they got a tax penalty of $250,000. A lot harder to administer a traditional DB because the stock market doesn't go this direction. It goes like this, up and down and up and down. And we do the val at the end of the year, and our actuaries come up and they say, hey, you're underfunded. Then we got to go back to the client, say you have to make it fully funded or you're going to get a penalty. They're not as fun to administer. Now, a DB plan next year, we know they're fully funded because it's not going down. It's always going up. 3% annuity next year, can you tell me what the value is going to be? Yeah. Can you tell me what the guaranteed cash value in the insurance policy is going to be next year? Yeah. So we know where we're going. But can you tell me what the value of my Fitbit stock is going to be next year? Can you? What's the theoretical value of my Fitbit stock next year? What's the theoretical value? Tell me what my guaranteed value of Fitbit stock is. I have Fitbit stock. Zero. That's correct. The theoretical or the guaranteed value of my Fitbit stock 10 years from now is zero. You have to have more eyeballs looking at, harder to administer. So we did check other TPAs, and they're in the same range. $5,000 to $15,000 for traditional and cash balance. You know, $1,500 to $2,500 for fully insured. It's everywhere. It's not just us. Large plans, like if you go to Millman Buck, $40,000 and up for the large plans per year. Yeah, the fees are tax deductible. There you go. Can't beat tax deductible fees. That's correct. Do you have to include everyone? We said no. Constant, no, there can be some changes you can make, et cetera. Business can exclude part-time employees less than 21 years, less than 1 year of service. We already went through 3 years. We also went through the vesting schedule, and we didn't spend 2 weeks at it. You could, because there's a lot here. We had one plan that was not paired that was using an elapsed time method, which the employee had to be employed at the end of the year, and we made it plan sponsors call, and they called the person out. Okay, because they weren't there. It's an elapsed time. It's a different method. Like I said, you could literally spend 2 weeks on eligible investing, but I don't think you're going to find that interesting. Three factors: contribution by income, age, numbers of years to retirement. The older client gets the larger contribution. Who's the business owner? The young 28-year-old or the older 58-year-old? It's the older person. So they're going to get the larger contribution, and they're the ones that make the decision what type of plan they want to install. Okay. All right, now establishing and funding. You have to have this done by the end of the year. We're going into pension season, and you all know that. Pension season lasts October, November, December. 80% of the cases will be done in the next 3 months, maybe 90%. Because the clients have to do this. Set up the plan by the end of the year. If not, goodbye, Charlie. Which means you have to have a legal document done, tax ID number filled out. Funding can take place till you file your tax return, but you better have this set up by the end of the year. Every year, including last year, so we got 6 clients on December 31st. 6 of them. 7. Well, we want to set it up now. Can we do it? Yeah. I got all the documents. Press all the buttons. Send it to them. Send it. Get the tax ID number from the service. Assuming the IRS is open. We had 2 years with the IRS closed. I don't know if you went through that. And we couldn't get the tax ID. You did go through it. See, he does administration too, so you understand. So the thing is, you couldn't get the tax ID number. So some of the clients go, well, they can't get it till January. Can we do it in January? Just backdate the document. I'm a lawyer. I lose my license. So I'm not going to do that. But I have another problem. How do I get the tax ID number backdated by the service? If you can show me that, then we show it. So it's end of the year or goodbye, buddy. You know, we're not going to do that. Then you have time to fund it. Oh, we can do it in 24 hours. We can do it in an hour. It's not because we're streamlined. We've been doing it for years. But don't ask us on December 31st like a half a dozen do every year. You know? Oh, it can happen until they file their tax return, including extensions. September 15th is coming around. I got money going on the plans right now all over the country. I get phone calls. I'm sitting there looking at the internet all the time. Oh, this guy needs a document. We're just funding this one in Washington, D.C. I got another one going in Hawaii. Da-da. It's all done. They have to have it in by September 15th because that's the due date of the corporate return. So once that's done, we're done. Then you fill out the 5500 every year. Fun area to work in. Do you want to open this file? No. Okay. That's brilliant. How do you do this? Seriously. What happens if it doesn't show up on the computers? That is odd. Okay. No, it's not on the right side. But the good news is there's only one more slide. Oh, gosh. All right. The good news is this, conclusion. Like I said, the good news is there's only one more slide, and we're at the hour. This is for professionals, business owners who like to maximize tax deductions, guaranteed retirement. Not for everybody, but fact is the applications are much larger than you would think. Medical Economics did a survey. They said 94% of physicians should have them, and only 6% do. And so the thing is, and I know after working with these doctors for decades, the reason why they work 13 hours a day to get an hour with them to talk about the retirement plan and saving $50,000 to $100,000 income, next to impossible, I got to go to work. Why? Don't want to pay my income tax bill. Did you take retirement plans when in med school? No. Do you know anything about financial planning? No. Have you ever thought that rather than work your butt off, take 3 months off, set up your pension plan, get all the bloody money back? No. But my CPA didn't tell me anything about it. We already know your CPA didn't because your CPA didn't know anything about pensions. No. Does this go on every day? Yes. This has been the market for 17 years. So it hasn't changed and probably won't. And I tell Max and Brad, I said, hadn't changed 17 years, won't in the next 17 years maybe. That is what it is. But anyway, thank you for attending, and I hope you enjoyed the rest of your day and the time at the conference. Thank you very much. Thank you.